to the Modern Law Library. I'm your host, Julianne Hill. I'm a legal affairs writer at the ABA Journal. Today, I'm joined by Anne Bremner. She's an attorney in Seattle and a television legal analyst. We'll be talking about her new book, Justice in the Age of Judgment, From Amanda Knox to Kyle Rittenhouse, and the Battle for Due Process in the Digital Age. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's such an honor.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So your book goes through a dozen or so cases to ultimately show how the concept of innocent until proven guilty is under fire in high-profile cases. Let's start with Amanda Knox.
Well, where do I begin? I mean, hers was the first truly internet, social media, you know, examination of international criminal trials that we've really seen. And what's happened after that, of course, I've talked about in the book, my brother and I have. But in Amanda Knox's case, she basically was, per the tabloids, arrested for turning cartwheels at the police station, going out for pizza with her boyfriend, buying lingerie, they said, but she just needed underclothes because she didn't have a place to go or stay. And that she acted in a way that they thought looked guilty. She's a little bit quirky. But those types of observations became huge in the headlines, saying that it was a satanic ritualistic sex laying, that she was a temptress, tempting Raffaele, her co-defendant, into this group sex ritual homicide, that she didn't like her roommate, that she's basically it was kind of like the Madonna whore kind of image of women, and about America. But she was very pretty, and so that also worked against her in the media. And finally, her social media all came up, where she was standing like with what looked like a submachine gun, or her boyfriend is wrapped up, you know, and then with some kind of mummy tape with a knife. And so a lot of that was played out. And then, of course, they talked about her sexual history and broadcast that, and even told her that she had HIV/AIDS. So that case really, I think, fascinated not just the Italians, but everybody around the world, because of the salacious type of media that was false, but was out there.
What made that case blow up? I mean, she's an American college student. She's living abroad. What is it that spoke to people around the world that got them so interested and made this go on its own journey, shall we say?
Yeah. And it was quite a journey, because it was about a decade and she spent 4 years in prison in Italy. I think that for a lot of people, it's like, how could she be from Seattle and Seattle Prep and be seemingly angelic? There's a book about her called Angel Face, but yet be this vicious murderer. I think that fascinates people. So the media portrayal made people even more interested, because how could she have just turned on a dime, you know, into this monster? But I also think the American abroad, some of the really basic things, I can't tell you how many parents I heard from saying that's my worst nightmare, that I send my child abroad, right, for study abroad, and then something like this happens. It was like, you know, that we called it the Menini Express. That was the name of the prosecutor, that all of a sudden she was in the vortex and she couldn't get out. But I also think if you look at the Scott Peterson case or other cases we talk about in the book, why did the Scott Peterson case get so much attention? Well, All American Next Door. She was going to have a baby. It's Christmas. These are basic things to us that we identify with, you know, in other people. And I think Amanda was one of those people, too.
In the book, you mentioned the girl next door, the boy next door story, and how it gave me pause, I will say that, where how we all judge, how would I have missed that? How could I miss this horrible person next door where they look so sweet and innocent?
Right. And that's Scott Peterson's case. You know, if I can't identify evil when it lives next door, I can never identify it. And that's something that I think people are really fearful of. You know, when you see a crime committed and the neighbors, how often do they say, I saw it coming, that was a horrible person, right? You usually see them saying, I had no idea. You know, this is shocking. I didn't see it. I didn't see evil next door.
So in your book, you looked at O.J. Simpson and Michael Jackson and Mary Kay Letourneau and the Peterson case you mentioned. There were about a dozen or so. Are there certain elements that make sure, kind of, that these type of case lend themselves to this type of media circus?
I always think they're almost morality plays. Like when you look at any case, like Michael Jackson, for instance, you know, that F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, show me a hero and I'll write you a tragedy. I mean, that really was Michael Jackson. And, you know, Scott Peterson, would you know evil if it lived next door? Amanda Knox, I mean, an innocent abroad, you know, that whole concept of can that be? And then if you look at, you know, other cases, Betty Broderick was a lesser known case, but that whole, you know, hell hath no fury, but yet she's a housewife that put her husband through medical school and law school and raised four kids and had a license plate that said, load him up. And he leaves her for a woman that looks exactly like she did at the age she got married. And she just snapped. He took the kids away, took all the money, everything else. And she was the most popular Oprah Winfrey guest, I think, of all time back then. So that resonates for a different reason, which is a lot of women can see themselves in that position, especially back when this happened 25 years ago.
In the book, you say that Knox is to social media what OJ was to cable television. Has social media changed the story, the way that people look for that confirmation bias?
Absolutely. We saw it in the Johnny Depp versus Amber Heard case. That was a TikTok trial. I mean, he was invincible on TikTok. It was unbelievable to see the avalanche of support for him. And of course, all over Instagram and everywhere else, but especially TikTok. I've just finished trying a case. I was defending the sheriff of the second largest county in Washington State, where social media had him condemned, guilty. A lot of it was social media. And he was acquitted. But the media going into it was staggering. And it happened throughout the whole trial that all these things were coming out. And this was broadcast live on a live stream like the Depp versus Heard case. So you're having ongoing commentary. So it's different than OJ. We all kind of watch, but we didn't participate, right? Now we watch and we participate and we condemn or we applaud.
That's really, really interesting to me, is the engagement and the feeling that you as the audience are part of the story. Is traditional media still as heavy of an influence? Could OJ happen in the same way again?
I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I think no. I mean, I think that it's just so different with, you know, streaming and all the social media and all the different groups and this, you know, the cyber sleuths and everything else. I don't know if you saw the show, the Cecil Hotel, but remember all the web sleuths were very busy. And I think it's great that people are engaged in the justice system, but it can have its drawbacks too, because everyone's a journalist. No one's a journalist. Everyone's involved, but not everybody knows everything unless they're watching every single day and have a little more expertise than just being an armchair quarterback.
And as you mention over and over again in your book, confirmation bias, we're looking mm-hmm. for the things that we already believe in that first impression that people made.
Right. And there's a study that there's no citation for, but we hear it often, that 80% of jurors make up their mind in an opening statement and they never change their mind. They filter all the evidence through opening. And that confirmation bias, I mean, it's human nature. You make up your mind and you're convinced no matter what. And my brother had some studies that he cited in the book. People are not going to change their mind.
Your brother is a psychiatrist.
Yeah, my brother's a psychiatrist. And so he cited some studies. There was one at Stanford, which is where I went, and some other studies dealing with that people are not going to change their minds once they made up their minds. And it doesn't matter what evidence that they're confronted with, they're going to stick with that first thought, and it's confirmation bias. And that's a huge problem in high-profile criminal trials.
So as we mentioned, Amanda was tried in the Italian court system, and that underscored to me that this is not just an American justice problem. It doesn't matter really where you're being tried. The court of public opinion is now global. And that's a different scene than even OJ, where it was a global phenomenon to be sure, but it was a little more insular, it felt.
Right. And I think like Amanda's case, you know, everyone felt like they knew her, and people had, talking about confirmation bias, there were those that were absolutely convinced she was guilty, no matter what they heard, no matter even to this day that she's been exonerated, not just found not guilty, but exonerated in Italy. They still think she's guilty and they still write in the comment sections and they're still all over the internet. And then those, of course, that feel that she's completely innocent. And then there's people like my mom who think she must have done something wrong to end up, you know, being prosecuted. But, you know, somewhere in between. But people don't change their minds. And and the media against her was just staggering. And she was in a secret hearing for a year, for some time. You know, in Washington, it'd be 72-hour hold if you're arrested before charging. In Italy, it's far much longer. And it's a closed hearing. So all kinds of kind of false information was leaking out from that closed hearing. And that's what really made that case stand out in terms of the wrongful media, I think, and what led to a wrongful conviction in the first trial.
This seems like a natural place to take a quick break. So when we return, I'll be asking Ann Bremner how gender plays into the judgment in these high-profile cases.
Delegate out those tasks that take up your time. Staffy can help you with your legal, administrative, marketing, and even client-facing workload. Hiring Staffy's top-notch bilingual virtual staff means Staffy does the recruiting, hiring, and training for you. Then, if you need a change, Staffy handles it. You get to concentrate on your strategic work. Schedule a free consultation at staffy.cc. That's STAFI.cc and get $500 off with code HAPPY24.
Welcome back to the Modern Law Library. Ann Bremner, author of Justice in the Age of Judgment, is with us. And in your book, you talked about Amanda Knox's girl next door look and how that made her seem more guilty. Let's talk about that and explore what a woman has to deal with in these types of cases.
Well, Raffaele, her Slichito, her co-defendant, people were not interested in him. I've spent time with him. I gave a speech with him in Prague in the Czech Republic. He's a lovely young man, but the interest was in Amanda Knox, the pretty girl from Seattle. And, you know, all the thoughts of, you know, was she interested in sex with these people? Was she, hate her roommate? I mean, just the dissection of her. And finally, I think people can't believe that women commit crimes like that. And so you got the whole evil next door, like what I've seen in it, it's something of what I've seen in her, you know, that I would have known it, that she was, you know, that the prosecutor called her the she-devil. That was used in closing argument about her. Yeah, she-devil. That she was, you know, evil and incarnate. And we talk about in the book a little bit of ritualistic mysticism in Italian history that played into this. But the fact that she was female was everything. Because look at her co-defendant. No interest, little to no interest in the press.
Overall, in the book, you show a pattern that women in these high-profile cases tend to get sent to prison. And men often, not always, but often get let go. Why is that? Is it bad moms, the Madonna whore?
I don't know. I think that women are so scrutinized in society and objectified in society, but also I think in many ways marginalized by society. Women don't have the power, you know, over the years to defend themselves. Women don't have the same personalities often as men to be a lot more affirmative about their innocence. I think women, I always want to say that we're the kinder, gentler gender, but that's true, that you can have women end up in bad circumstances like Amanda did because she wanted to help the police and went to the police station and ended up in prison. She should have just gotten the next plane and gone home. There was nothing to hold her on, but instead she cooperated. And if you look at a lot of these cases, Mary Kay Letourneau was my case, Betty Broderick, I represented her, Rebecca Zahao in Coronado. You know, a lot of these women, you know, were very attractive, were very vulnerable. And I think that society is fascinated with women in crime. If they're in crime, they may not be, like Amanda Knox. But she was portrayed as being a woman, a young woman at the time, 19, in crime.
And so men have more power. They might have more access to money, which brings in different lawyers and just a different set of rules.
Absolutely. And we all know that if money can't buy you justice, but money can certainly help, you know, in terms of a defense and power and all of those things. And I also talked about Frances Farmer, who was from Seattle, West Seattle, where Amanda was from, for that same reason. I mean, she was somebody that ended up in Western State Hospital, and they say she had a lobotomy. And Kurt Cobain named his daughter after her, Frances being Cobain, and he wrote a song about her. But beautiful woman, very smart, wrote an essay called God is Dead. She got a lot of negative attention and she was pretty feisty and ended up in Western State for many, many years out here in Washington.
As you were writing the book and it was focused primarily on Amanda, mm-hmm. George Floyd was killed and the Black Lives Matter movement grew. What's the connective tissue between these cases that made you include them in the book?
I think every single case, there was confirmation bias, but I also think every single case was distorted and warped in the media. And I don't care which case it was. I mean, there are more extreme examples than other, for example, Rittenhouse. What was in the media was completely an opposite to what the testimony was. And still people would look at that testimony and say, you know, he should have been convicted because of their perception of him going into it. George Floyd and Derek Chauvin, there would never be an acquittal in that case, never, because of that video. And that tells you how important it is pre-trial for the courts not to release evidence like that, in my opinion, until the trial. They also released the settlement. Remember in Minneapolis, it was multi-millions during jury selection. So, I mean, that was a foregone conclusion, in my opinion, that was going to be the verdict that was rendered. And then when you look at, you know, any of the other cases I talked about, every single one of them had a trail of media that was either so extreme against the defendant that a jury did the opposite in their verdict, or it was just wrong. And then in many ways, and then basically you've got to play cleanup hitter as a lawyer. I don't fault the media. All of us, we have very little time, right? And that includes people in the media. That's why we form opinions and move on, right? I mean, that's why we basically can say, I got it. I saw this headline, I saw this or that, and I understand. But a trial, as you know, is completely different. And the influence from media, social media, et cetera, is, in my opinion, almost insurmountable. And it wasn't the case I just tried, but we won. But I also, during the whole trial, was watching Twitter, watching the media, and communicating with these folks. That's not what was said. That's not what the evidence was. You've got to do it as you go. So the thread to answer your question is, you know, all of these just have tremendous interest. And I think it's great. You know, I think educating the public with our cases and our trials is wonderful. And people are interested is wonderful. And on these live streams and commenting and everything else. But we've got to understand that a headline here or a column there or just a perp walk or some image, it's just not enough. And it plays over to jurors and ultimately to verdicts.
What can lawyers do in these cases? What lessons are there for them, for the prosecutors and the defense on these super high profile cases that are being played out and the narrative kind of spins out of their control? How do they pull it back?
I think the most important thing they can do is to harness all of the media and be familiar with everything that's out there. It's funny, back in the day, we used to have clipping services. Now it's a lot different to find everything in the media, but to find everything there. And then to basically, you've got to start a truth campaign. You've got to, they did this in the Duke LaCrosse case, where that anytime someone went on the air and said something condemning the Duke LaCrosse players, those lawyers or their staff would reach out to the commentator and say, that's not right. You know, the whole time. And ultimately that prosecutor, Mike Nifong, was of course prosecuted, convicted and disbarred. Very extreme, like Manini and in Amanda Knox's case, her prosecutor. But I think you have to exactly know what all of it is. And then you need to go into your trial with your things combating whatever it was. I don't think you need to have your client out there talking, but I think you need to be out there talking to level the playing field. It's not unethical to come out and basically try to level the playing field under Shepard versus Maxwell and other cases, especially when you're defending. And then through the whole trial, like I said, you've got to keep on engaging with members of the press. People will send you terrible emails. I get terrible things on social media about my client. You know, how do you deal with that? I don't engage, you know, if it's something that's just troll-like. I just don't think it's worth it. But I think you can really understand the media and harness those themes that you're hearing and then combat them. And because you're trying to case two places, you're trying it in public, you're trying it in a courtroom.
Is there a tendency for prosecutors to sometimes get caught up in making a case for the accused for being a bad person and kind of forget about the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
How and why does that happen?
They must learn it in prosecutor school. I don't know. I was a prosecutor. I think, yeah, I mean, a bad person, you know, did a bad thing, and good people usually don't do bad things. So there's a lot of interest, I think, in prosecutors to portray people, you know, as bad people and try and get in as much evidence as they can, prior bad acts, prior complaints, you know, anything bad that they did, they'll try and get it in. They didn't pay their taxes. I mean, that's a big thing with jurors. If they're dishonest in something and the fraud, et cetera. Michael Jackson, the complaining witness's mom, took the Fifth on, I think it was like perjury and welfare fraud and something else, and she took the stand. So there you've got a witness, you know, the prosecutor's like, that's the opposite. It's because they called her, but that's an example of where somebody can really get tripped up is on priors. But yeah, I mean, that's what they want to do. Should they do that? No. I mean, unless it's clearly admissible, you know, and it's often not. And look at Weinstein and Epstein, you know, when they're trying to say all these other victims or even Cosby. I don't really agree with that thought of just bringing a parade of, you know, horribles and a parade of other victims if they're not charged counts.
And as you mentioned with Rittenhouse, you have to guide the narrative back to what the laws are that are governing that society, whether it's Wisconsin or Italy, or right to get a verdict.
Right. He had a right under the law there that he was lawfully in possession of that weapon. And then it was hard to believe, I think, for a lot of people. But if he analyzed each act of violence, each constituted arguably self-defense under the law there. The defense doesn't have a burden on self-defense. The prosecutor does, as you know, to disprove the self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. Given those things, jurors followed the law and found that he wasn't guilty. And I really think if people read this book, they take away from it that people after Rittenhouse said he's still guilty, he shouldn't be out, you know, everything else. We really need to pay attention to the courts, what is adduced in the trial, what the law is, and respect jurors, you know, for what they do and how they render their verdicts, because, you know, Abraham Lincoln said it's the highest calling of citizenship, and I think that's true.
This seems like a good place to take another break. When we return, I'll be asking Anne Bremner about the lessons that being a lawyer offers for aspiring writers. Welcome back to the Modern Law Library. Anne Bremner, author of Justice in the Age of Judgment, is here with us, and tell me about some tips that you got for writing from being a lawyer. How did that help you in crafting a book?
I've said my book's like a TikTok book because each one of the cases is pretty short. You know what I mean? But because I think that's the interest level people have. They read about the case, what was the media, what's the lesson, et cetera. And brevity, you know, solo wit. I think that's something I learned from being a lawyer. And storytelling. That's what we do, especially in opening statements and trials. And so I think the book, I needed help from my brother, who is a psychiatrist, and he was at Yale, and then he's now at Emory. But he really helped me put together some of the bigger issues in the case, PTSD, the fallacy or the law, memory issues, confirmation bias, all those kinds of things. So from being a lawyer, I think we all know when you need help, you better ask for it. And so I did, because I thought it needed to go to the next level.
Is writing a book a little bit like building a case?
Yeah, definitely. I love trials, you know, and it is a lot like that, you know, and like you think about it, you imagine it, you talk to your friends about it. You know, it's almost like music. You know, I play classical piano, so it's like a sonata, you know, and you've got different movements and different speeds and moods. And then kind of this whole finesse and finale that makes sense and resonates with people. You know, it's not just the case. It's everyone wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. And I think trials are about that, you know, that you rise up to something bigger than yourself. And that's kind of the thought behind the book, but also the thought behind trials.
Is writing an opening statement like writing the first chapter of a book?
Yeah, I think so. Opening statement. And, you know, we say that in trials. We'll say this is like, you know, basically a preview of things to come, or an index in a book, or first chapter in a book where you set it all up so that people are really interested and can follow through from what you said in the opening. Absolutely.
And the importance of storytelling is important in both the courtroom and on the page.
They're the same, I think. They're absolutely the same. And we tried a case recently that was the Susan Cox Powell case, where she was murdered by her husband. The kids end up with the state. Mm-hmm. And the kids are killed by the dad because the state doesn't, you know, do the right things. And the jury returned a verdict of $115 million for us. But that case, those jurors felt something bigger than themselves. That's the most extreme example in my life. And it's in the book. of just rising up. It was during the pandemic. The jurors were on hiatus for months, and they came back and heard the rest of the case. And to this day, I hear from them, and they want to help and participate in the system. So that, to me, is just so satisfying that a jury became so involved in a case, but also a movement.
And they're involved in the story. I mean, being a juror is a way mm-hmm. of being part of the story.
They're exactly the part of the story. And it's a continuing story.
So what's next for you? Another book? Or do we have another book inside of you? Do we have that to look forward to?
Maybe. Having done this, I'm like, maybe we do want to do it again. I'll see if my brother's willing. But we had, you know, it was so interesting to do. And it's so interesting to spend time with him and to understand what we do for a living, you know, as lawyers. And people say, well, isn't this autobiographical? And I'm like, not really. It's about cases I cover as an analyst nationally. It's about cases I tried. And it's also about cases that hold people's interests. This interested me, and it was kind of cathartic to go through all of it and say, how does this all make sense, right? And writing a book, as you know, you kind of at the end say, no, it makes sense to me. And I hope it makes sense to others. But maybe I just retire, but I don't think I'm going to do that. I said that to a couple of people in my firm the other day, and they went, you know, like, oh my God, you're not going to retire. So maybe another book. And I think, you know, Clarence Darrow said most people only have about 5 big trials in them. And I think I'm pretty close to done with trying big cases. Maybe one more, but not beyond that.
So working with your brother, was this the first time you two worked together on anything?
Mm-hmm. It was the first time we worked together on anything. And he was someone that discovered, one of the first people that discovered memory. Basically, PTSD can come from, you know, Vietnam vets, you know, sexual assault survivors, that it can actually damage your brain, you know, physically. And so we always said, you know, he was more interested in the brain and all this, you know, scientific stuff. And he's written a bunch of books about the brain. So I never thought, would Doug write a book with me? And then he said, well, why don't you just tell me about how you got involved in Amanda's case? You know, tell me about how you felt about this case. And then he wrote it. And it was beautiful. He majored in English at UPS out here in Washington. And it was his first love. And it was fun for him to write a book, not about the brain or about PTSD, but about, you know, to tell these stories. And he became very invested. And maybe we can do it again, but he's my little brother. You know, we've always been close. And it was really fun to do together.
Did you write every day? What was your process?
It was sporadic. But at the end, it was fast and furious when we're like, we're going to get this done. And my brother's a taskmaster. So he would say, you got to get this done. And I'm like, okay. You know. So it started out, you know, kind of sporadic. And it started out as a book about Amanda Knox. And then, as you can see, it became something very different. But it's like the constant theme, as you can see, was Amanda Knox. We just went through the progression of her case. And then in between those progressive chapters, we had other cases, because I think that was a good way to carry the reader through a real injustice when we looked at other cases.
What do you want readers to walk away from this book?
That our system is the best in the world, but that we're up against a real assault, I think, on the presumption of innocence. And I think that we have to understand that we can't compartmentalize or, you know, look at cases the way that we used to, because we're bombarded all the time by everyone's opinion. We have to look at it like people look at politics. We're a divided nation, we're a divided era. And people hate Trump, or people don't like Biden, or, you know, everyone wants to, like, it's all over except for the shouting. Everybody wants to have a say, and who they, you know, nobody's listening. If you're talking, you're not listening. It's like that in the legal system. I think Weinstein, he was gone. I mean, there's no way he was going to get up and fight again. Cosby, he won his appeal. People still have, you know, nothing but disgust for him and disdain. I think that we need to let the system work, you know, and the fact is that it works very well. Scott Peterson, 20 years later, just had an appeal heard, you know, and the people need to respect that. That's why we have the system. We have great judges, we have great jurors, we have great lawyers, and it all fits together and works. And it's not like Amanda Knox, who basically, you know, was the she-devil abroad that was never going to be seen as innocent, never. And my little brother's wife is Italian. My niece was staying with me at the second conviction. You know, they had triple jeopardy. They tried her three times. She was staying with me. And I said, can you believe that Amanda Knox got convicted again? And she goes, oh, it's Italy, Ann. I totally believe it. I'm like, oh, that's sad. So you don't see that in our system. I think we all feel a certain level of pride in the United States system. And it works beautifully, but it works when it's adduced in court, period. And once that's done and the appeals are exhausted, that's something we have to live with. So it's kind of an old fashioned lesson I want learned. It's a whole different world these days, as you know, with media. And we just have to have these cases tried in the courtroom and without any evidence being released that's prejudicial, that shouldn't have been released by prosecutors, including, you know, trying to make someone look bad.
Thanks so much, Anne. I really appreciate your time and giving us some insight.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. And thanks so much to our listeners for hanging in with us. I'm Julianne Hill from ABA Journal, and I'm filling in for your usual host, Lee Rawls. If you enjoyed this episode of the Modern Law Library podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe in your favorite podcast listening service. And if you've read a book you'd like us to consider covering on the podcast, you can always reach us at books@abajournal.com. Thanks for listening.